welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. We're glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Dr. Tom Ezer says that a hardy variety of alfalfa developed from a German immigrant seed helped it withstand the Northern Plains cold and drought and fueled an agricultural revolution. And we begin Main Street today with rural newspapers. They still matter in North Dakota, and side note, they're making a comeback. In many rural communities, the local newspaper does far more than report the news. Its pages document births and deaths, school activities, local businesses, elections, and the decisions made by city councils, school boards, and county commissions. Taken together, those weekly editions become a community's permanent record. But producing that record has been increasingly difficult in North Dakota. Rural newspapers are contending with rising costs, staffing shortages, changing advertising habits, and postal expense and delays that can leave time-sensitive editions sitting undelivered for maybe days or even weeks. Jill Fries is the owner of GS Publishing, which operates 7 weekly newspapers in southwestern North Dakota. She has stepped in to preserve newspapers that were facing closure and has become a prominent advocate for local journalism and government transparency. She's also the president of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, the first person in a century to hold that position twice. Jill joins us to talk about what it takes to keep rural newspapers alive and why their survival matters well beyond the newspaper business. Jill, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Main Street.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for having me here.
How did you find your way into the newspaper business?
It's actually a funny story. I went to the University of Mary and Bismarck for English and Communications, and I had no desire to be in the newspaper world at all. I anticipated doing something in public relations for a construction company. I had a very small mindset, a very narrow path of where I thought my life would lead me. And while I was at the University of Mary, I met a farmer, and shortly after graduating, I married him and moved to New Leipzig, North Dakota, which is about 75 miles southwest of Bismarck. And there aren't a lot of construction companies, and there isn't a big need for a public relations person there. So walking up and down the street, the main street, I found a little local newspaper called the Grand County News and Carson Press, and Duane and Gail Schatz were the owners of the Grant County News and Carson Press back then. They opened up their business, really hired me when they didn't need anybody. They just hired me because I was new and I needed a job. So I started at the newspaper doing typesetting for 2 days a week. 8 years into it, they decided that they would like to retire and offered me the business. And that's when I really, really dug deep into the newspaper industry and decided this was the job that was probably made for me. I just didn't know it. So once in a while, your job finds you. You don't find your job.
We're going to talk more about the importance of community newspapers here in just a little bit. But I'm curious about your day. In the open, I noted that you operate 7 weekly newspapers across southwestern North Dakota. What do you do? And what do you do with your staff trying to accomplish before the papers even go to press?
So our Mondays and Tuesdays are our production days. So those are pretty hectic days. I stay in pretty close contact with everybody across the GS Publishing staff, answering questions. We're working on things together. We're editing stories. And then I also produce the Grant County News and the Carson Press at my office in Elgin. That's the home office that I work out of. So my Mondays and Tuesdays are pretty busy. I normally get to work about 7 o'clock on a Monday morning and work until about 3 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, take a couple hours to get a little snooze, and then I'm up at it at 6 the next morning working and trying to get those papers ready for the deadline on Tuesdays. And then on Wednesday mornings, we all gather for an editorial meeting. It's a Zoom meeting, but we can all get together for a little while and talk about what story ideas we're working on and any issues that people are facing or problems, or if anybody has any ideas. I have an incredible staff. They are just an amazing group of people, and they've brought in podcasts to GS Publishing. So we have those on our website and we have those on our Facebook pages. We're talking about doing kind of a reporter roundtable podcast. We're doing a newsletter. We're doing a much more in-depth website. And so we are trying to delve a little bit more into the digital world and just try and meet our readers where they're at also. So then on Wednesdays, everybody kind of goes their own way and they start producing their stories. I do a lot of job work, so I'm pretty busy on Wednesdays and Thursdays doing producing job work, like statements for people or posters or brochures or the sports programs, things like that. And then I'm also the main bookkeeper for all seven newspapers. So while everybody gathers up the their Excel sheets about the advertising that they've had in their newspapers or obituaries or anything like that, I work on Thursdays and Fridays trying to gather all of that information and put that into our QuickBooks system. In addition to being the main person that everybody calls with problems and doing the maintenance and the upkeep of the offices. So, and I try really hard to get to several of my offices as often as I can just to spend some time with those employees because they deserve a little bit of one-on-one time with me also. So we try and go out to lunch or just try and do a couple meetings here and there just to go over things that might be easier for them or better the office that they work out of.
Do you worry about burnout, Jill? That's an incredible schedule.
So actually, this has been this week right now that I'm in Omaha has been really interesting for me because I am working remotely. And I actually just wrote my editorial about this is that, you know, as my children are spreading their wings and flying, it's okay for me to spread my wings a little bit and fly. So learning to work remotely and being here and celebrating these big milestones with my children is very important to me and not missing out on things with my family or friends or things like that. So burnout is a real concern, but I think because of the staff I have, I'm looking forward to being able to take just a tiny bit of a step back and let them take some of these reins a little bit because they're incredible. They are so excited to be able to do some more in the industry. And for me, that's huge just to be able to have people I can trust and I know will also hold these newspapers just like a baby, like I do. These mean so much to me, and I never want anything detrimental to happen to them because I've poured so much of my heart and soul into them.
Each newspaper, as you mentioned, serves a different town, a different area. Is it hard to make sure every community feels that their newspaper is their own and belongs to it?
No, absolutely not. That's why we have staff set in every single community. We have a couple things, like our editorial page, that gets placed in all of the papers. So that's one page of shared content, but that's the only thing that is shared. So every newspaper has their very own voice and really reflects the community that it serves. And our communities are so different. So some communities like to focus a little bit more on sports, and some communities really don't like that focus. So we focus a little bit more on just what's happening in the community. So it is, they're all very different newspapers.
Jill Friess is my guest. She's the owner of GS Publishing, which operates seven weekly newspapers in southwestern North Dakota. Jill, what can a locally owned newspaper understand about a community that a larger news organization or social media page just might miss?
I think it's because we are situated in our community. I go and sit in church next to these people. I go to the cafe and have lunch next to these people. They see me at the grocery store. Any place I am, people come up to me and tell me about story ideas. And that is true with all of my staff. We're located in the communities where our newspapers are. We are living there. We're doing our grocery shopping there. We're part of the community. And so people in those communities feel comfortable talking to us about what's going on, whether it's good or bad. And we are just reporting the news that's within our communities. We're not three states away trying to figure out what to put in the paper. We don't use filler because we have so much local news to put in our papers. Sometimes we don't even have enough room on our pages to put those stories. So people always comment, they're like, oh my gosh, you are from a small town. How can you find anything to put in the newspaper? Trust me, there is always plenty to put in the newspaper. And if you want to be busy in a small community, you definitely can be. Just volunteer, join an organization, be a part of the community, and you will stay plenty busy.
Do you feel that newspapers are, in a way, having a new beginning, a renaissance, if you will?
Oh, absolutely. For one, weekly newspapers were never, ever in threatened or in dire need of changing what we're doing. We were never going to die. Weekly newspapers are an entirely different animal than a daily newspaper. And right now, I think people are getting really tired of looking at their telephone for everything. They're really tired of just the screen time. So what we're finding is that more people are reverting back to actual print version. They want that. They want to be able to hold that tangible product in their hand and read the newspaper as it gets delivered to them. And I think they are seeing the importance of having actual journalists give them the news instead of trying to listen to what's being told to them over social media. Because right now, you know probably as well as I do, with AI, we don't know what's true on social media and not. And I would say probably a very small percentage of what you read on social media is actually true anymore. So I think people are much more interested in getting something from a recognized news organization that they know and trust.
How do you get your newspaper delivered to the people that want to read it?
Okay, so this is a big point of contention for me, actually. So we rely on the United States Postal Service. So every Tuesday afternoon, we send our papers to Garrison, to Nordak North, to have them printed. They do a fantastic job. They work through the night. They get our papers out for us. They take them to the post office for us. And every single reader is supposed to have their newspaper in their mailbox by Thursday morning. Well, several Thursday mornings roll around, and we get a call from the post office, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry to tell you, you know, your newspapers didn't show up today. So then the calls from readers start coming in,
sure.
And they're disappointed. We also are very frustrated that the newspaper hasn't arrived. So Friday morning rolls around, sometimes they don't show up. Saturday morning rolls around, sometimes they still don't show up.
Goodness.
It's been as late as Monday or Tuesday the next week when the newspaper actually arrives in the post office boxes. And for me, that's just unacceptable service because we pay so much money to have that service provided to us. And our readers pay money to have that service provided to them, and they are frustrated. And I understand their frustration when they call, and I empathize with them. And what makes me happy, though, is that they're calling me because they're missing the product that we're putting out. So I know that the product we are producing is a quality product because our readers are upset that they're not getting it. So while I'm upset that they're calling because they have not received the paper in the mail, it also makes me smile just a little bit internally because I know that they're missing the product we're putting out there. So we have had so many conversations with the United States Postal Service, and their service is just declining, declining, declining. So we're trying to figure out what to do. I'm actually traveling in September to a fly-in in Washington, D.C. to try and talk to anybody that will listen to us about the Postal Service issues that we're experiencing.
Jill, have you seen a community lose its newspaper? And then if you have, what did you notice?
So there have been three communities that I've taken over that have lost their newspapers. But then I came in and took those over. There was one other community I believe it was Dunn County. At the time that I purchased the Adams County Record and the Hettinger County Herald, that newspaper had also shut down because they were owned by the same large company. But for me, that was just too far away from my home base. I couldn't get up there, and I couldn't do justice to that community by taking that over. And from what I understand, they just don't have much local coverage at all. So when you don't have that local coverage, you're losing out on recording the history of your community. Who's recording that if there is no newspaper? Where are you going to go back and look up who had a baby or who made the motion for a county commission major decision or when the streets were redone or anything like that? There are so many decisions and so many facts that people look up in a newspaper 20, 30, 40 years down the line.
How do you find your staff? You've talked about your great staff. How do you keep journalists in communities where one reporter might cover city government and the high school football game and everything else that happens in the community?
I have actually had fantastic luck on journalismjobs.com. I have an amazing young gal at the Golden Valley News. Her name is Jordana. She is from Delaware. She was a recent graduate, and she decided to make the move to North Dakota. I just hired a young man from Dallas, Texas, also a recent college graduate, and he made the decision to move to the Morton County News Journal in Mandan. I have another young man from California. He made the decision to move to North Dakota for the Morton County News Journal. So we do have people from all over the United States. And luckily I have a couple people who are also homegrown. There's a young gal who is our managing editor at the Morton County News Journal, and she's actually from Lakota, North Dakota. She is a graduate of the University of Mary. And I've had a few interns that have been fantastic from University of Mary and Bismarck State College. So I work very closely with those college programs, and I'm always trying to encourage some of those young people to pursue a degree or pursue a career in journalism and maybe stay local. So it's sometimes not easy finding these people, but we're diligent. I'm interviewing people quite often.
Jill, some people I'm sure say, and you've heard, just move it online. Why isn't that, in your eyes, a complete solution for the communities you serve?
Well, one, because to be a recognized newspaper in North Dakota, you must provide a print product. That's part of the bylaws and the rules and regulations of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. And we have readers who don't want it online. Like I said earlier, we maybe have, if I were to take a guess, I would say we maybe have 20% of our readers reading the e-edition online. The rest of our readers are picking up that tangible product, and they want the newspaper in their home. So as long as my readers want it in print, I will provide it to them in print, because I too am a very tangible person. I like to hold that product in my hand. I look at a screen all day long, so I don't want to look at a screen when I get home at night. I want to hold something in my hand and be able to turn the pages and put it on my coffee table. So I have a stack of probably 14 weeks worth of newspapers on my coffee table at home. But if I have to look back at something, I can always just go grab that newspaper and look something up.
And not have to read it on a 2-inch wide screen.
Jill. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that people are going back to wanting it in print. We are reverting a little bit back, and people like that tangible product.
As you're aware, with your role in the North Dakota Press Association, North Dakota has debated whether government bodies, Jill, should continue publishing public notices in independent newspapers or place them only on government websites. In your eyes, what's at stake in that debate?
Well, I think when you publish things only on a website, you can make that website as obscure and difficult to navigate as possible. The people that read the newspapers, the weekly newspapers that we publish, they liked to see those notices. They want to read those minutes in the paper. They want to know if there's a bid coming up. This is information that's very important for our readers and everybody across North Dakota. This is how we get our information from the government. So I think it is very important that it is offered and out there to the public, so it's very easy for them to find, very easy for them to know what's going on. I am very against them doing anything on an obscure website.
What's North Dakota's Future of Local News initiative?
What we're trying to do is just make sure that every community has a newspaper and is covered and has that history covered by a newspaper. We have a few desert areas across North Dakota, so we're trying to just work really, really hard to make sure that those areas are covered and we can be reporting the news and recording that history across our state.
What are advertisers telling you about wanting to publish in a printed newspaper versus the options now that they have to advertise online?
Well, some people do. We hear quite a bit that, you know, well, we can just post it on Facebook. And that's great. I you know, I have a Facebook page as well for the newspapers, and I absolutely see that as a source of advertising, and that's fantastic. Go ahead and put it on Facebook, but you're only going to reach a small amount of people just due to the algorithm of Facebook. They are hiding advertisements, things like that, on those pages. So if you really want to reach a broader audience and you really want your information out there, you should probably be doing a combination of things. You should put it on Facebook. You should put it out on other social media platforms. You also should be putting it in the newspaper, because different people are reading different mediums and they're receiving that information in so many different areas and different platforms, different mediums. So that's always what I come back with when they say, you know, we're just using Facebook, it's fine. But you're not getting the reach that you probably could. And it's my job as a newspaper to try and spread the word and try and get as many people into your business as I possibly can. That's how I view advertising, is I want the businesses that use the newspaper to succeed. And I just want to celebrate everything that's happening in their business. So if you give us a chance to advertise that for you, we are just trying to drive business to your company.
Jill, who reads your newspaper? And I ask that question with the thought that often in public radio across the country, and even in here in our office in North Dakota, we think about, well, older people are consuming probably what we produce, but younger people may not be. So who reads your newspaper?
In our small communities, everybody reads the newspaper, because the kids in high school are featured in the newspaper. The people who go to the senior meals are featured in the newspaper. And everybody in between is featured in the newspaper at some point. So we're not heavy on just high school sports. We're not heavy on just things going on in the senior community. We try and get a little bit of everything in there. So it's really pertinent and appealing to all age groups. We do have a lot of young families who subscribe to the paper, because we have a lot of school news included in there. And of course we have a lot of the older generation, because we publish the minutes and the obituaries and just the goings on of the communities. So I don't think I could even just categorize one age group. We have such a diverse group of people that read the paper. I get comments from people of all ages on something they've read in the newspaper. And it's normally, I write an editorial every week. And so it's kind of become just a journal of my life. And it's therapeutic for me to just write things down and get it out from my body. And so I get a lot of comments on people reading my editorial. So I know people are reading the newspaper. And again, that's from all age groups are talking about it and have a comment about what I've written about.
Jill, as we wrap up our conversation today, in your role as president of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, what's top on your agenda?
I think probably the biggest thing right now is just making sure that we are not losing any more small newspapers. We've had some older publishers. There's been a couple publishers who've had health issues, but we have some new people coming in and taking those newspapers over. And that is so refreshing and so great to see that we do have people who are interested in taking on that role and becoming the newspaper of these communities. So I think that's a huge part, is just make sure that we always have those newspapers covered and we can find a buyer or somebody to come in and take those over. And again, the Postal Service, we need to do something to help make sure that our readers aren't frustrated and we can actually get those newspapers out in a timely manner.
Jill Fries is the owner of GS Publishing, which operates 7 weekly newspapers in southwestern North Dakota, and she's also the president of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Jill, thanks for joining us and sharing what's at stake when a rural community fights to keep its newspaper.
Can I add one more thing to this? This is just a personal plug for me.
You betcha.
So we are, one of these newspapers is called the Morton County News Journal, and we have an office in Mandan and an office in New Salem. And this particular newspaper I purchased a few years ago. It formerly was called the New Salem Journal. And so I purchased that newspaper and I decided to extend the reach into Mandan. And so far we have had such an incredible response to the newspaper, because there wasn't really a newspaper that was doing the community justice of serving everything that was going on in the community and showing up at meetings, showing up at the high school sports, showing up at ribbon cuttings of new businesses, or just telling the news and the stories of Mandan, New Salem, and Elmont. So we are trying really hard. We're on the ballot this fall to be the official newspaper of Morton County, and we would appreciate anybody and everybody who would vote for the Morton County News Journal to become that paper of record, because we're the ones that have the local reporters. We're the ones at every meeting, every event. We're recording the news for all of Morton County.
Best wishes, Jill. Thanks for joining us today. Still ahead on this Tuesday's Main Street, alfalfa fever on the northern plains, and a tough farm economy keeps old machinery in the fields, with new combines and sprayers costing as much as $1 million. We hope you'll stay with us. It all follows this news. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. At the beginning of the 20th century, alfalfa fever swept across the northern plains. Farmers and scientists saw enormous promise in a crop that could nourish livestock while surviving punishing drought and bitter winters. Historian Tom Easern tells how an immigrant farmer's perseverance helped create a variety suited to North Dakota.
At the beginning of the 20th century, the whole Northwest, now there was no Midwest or Great Plains then, this was the Northwest, was in the grip of a fever. Alfalfa fever. It was in the fields, in the newspapers, in the folklore, in the literature of the land. Willa Cather wrote alfalfa into the plot of her first great Nebraska novel, O Pioneers. Lawrence R. Waldron, the research scientist I've been talking about lately, was in the middle of all this. His 1911 experiment station bulletin, simply titled Alfalfa, was a manifesto on the subject, charting a pivotal place for this leguminous forage in North Dakota. Now, for those inclined to partake of the fever, the bad news first, establishing a stand of alfalfa was a putsy process. Waldron, the Dickinson substation scientist in charge of alfalfa work, warned, "Alfalfa must be inoculated. Nearly all North Dakota soils must be inoculated with alfalfa bacteria, which fixed the nitrogen for the plant." This involved the purchase of bags of soil scraped from fields where alfalfa had been grown previously and scattering the stuff across the field to be planted. Fortunately, the experiment stations in Dickinson and Fargo made the bags of inoculant available cheap. Then the alfalfa seed had to be drill planted with special plates to handle the tiny seed, and there needed to be a good moisture base to produce a stand. After that, though, alfalfa put down deep roots, as deep as 10 feet, making it, Waldron declared in uncharacteristic hyperbole, drought-defying, the prince of drought resistance. As a foodstuff for livestock, alfalfa did double duty, providing both forage value and protein content. And fortunately, Waldron announced, having done extensive testing, grim alfalfa is a very promising sort for North Dakota. Grim, that may not sound like a name with promise, but this strain of alfalfa was named after its developer, an immigrant farmer named Wendelin Grim. The agricultural historian Everett Edwards told the story of Grim and his alfalfa in the journal Minnesota History in 1938. Grim brought alfalfa seed with him from the German province of Baden and planted it in Carver County, Minnesota in 1958. Establishment was not immediate. The plants mostly winter-killed, but Grimm kept saving seed of the survivors until he had a reliably winter-hardy forage, which farmers took to calling everlasting clover. A schoolmaster named Arthur B. Lyman commenced promoting this everlasting clover and brought it to the attention of the University of Minnesota scientist, Professor Willett M. Hayes. It was Hayes who gave it the name Grim Alfalfa and commenced sending seed out for testing in neighboring areas, which was how Waldron at Dickinson, North Dakota, got involved. The popular belief was that the alfalfa had acclimatized itself to the Northwest, That is, just gotten accustomed to cold and drought until it survived. Professor Hayes, however, determined there was a DNA connection. He said that somehow, in the old country, the Siberian yellow-flowered alfalfa, Miticago falcata, had gotten mixed in with the purple-flowered strain common in Europe, Miticago sativa, and imparted resistance to the cross. Grimm was the catalyst for alfalfa fever in the Northwest, but it succeeded only because all the stars were aligned. The second Cota boom was on, and homesteading farmers needed crops adapted to new lands. Experiment station science was arriving at a professional state, and in this golden age of agriculture, there was venture capital and positive spirit to try new things. The beloved scent of alfalfa hay curing in the field is a reminder of that spirit.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. He writes and presents this essay, and it's part of his Plains Folk series.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2026 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. New farm equipment can now cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and in some cases as much as $1 million. With farm income falling and expenses remaining high, many producers are repairing decades-old machinery, adding selective upgrades, or hiring others to harvest their crops. Harvest Public Media's Emma George Griffin reports on how farmers are balancing time, efficiency, and debt.
If you visit Kellogg Family Farms in central Michigan, you'll see hundreds of acres of soybeans, century-old barns, and piles of old machinery.
Some of the equipment we'll never use again.
That's Dennis Kellogg, the sixth generation owner of Kellogg Farms.
But it's amazing how if I need a part or something that's similar that'll work on even a different brand, I'm able to go and find something that'll work.
Kellogg likes working on older equipment. He says it's easier and cheaper to repair machinery that's not computerized. But in recent years, it's become more of a necessity.
More than likely, we'd update if we had financial resource and the justification for it. We have a budget. We have to live within.
Kellogg and other farmers are coping with a tighter farm economy. With trade uncertainty and rising costs, producers don't have much more to spend on machines that can cost upwards of $1 million. Farm equipment sales have declined by more than 20% this year, according to data from the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. Drew Kinsey is an agriculture research analyst at the University of Missouri. While he says more farmers are now relying on old equipment, it's been a trend for years.
We go back 50 plus years ago, then it was much more common for every farm up and down the road to have new equipment.
He says until the late 90s, technological advancements made older machines obsolete. Now, Kinsey says even decades-old machines have the bare-bone capabilities to get the job done. Plus, he says new technology can even be installed in older equipment.
It's really been pretty revolutionary in the last 20 years as far as, you know, enabling farms to have older equipment still be competitive with the latest and greatest.
In Paducah, Kentucky, Donnie Edwards and his son have a repair shop on their 2,000-acre farm. That's especially handy since Edwards says new equipment is just too costly right now.
It's a tough pill to swallow. Well, you need to spend another $100,000 on computerized stuff for your combine, tractor, sprayer, everything that goes with it. But you're not going to make all that much more money.
Edward says he taught his son to repair equipment, knowing it's becoming almost a survival skill in farming. But by forgoing new technology, farmers may lose out on efficiency. That's according to Doug Hauser, who specializes in digital agriculture at Iowa State University. He says farmers have to be extremely intentional when deciding what services and equipment are worth investing in.
A lot of farmers right now are stepping back and trying to figure out their equipment plans, whether it's more maintenance or if it's time to trade into maybe not new paint, but maybe some used updated equipment.
Some farmers are sidestepping big purchases like combines by hiring out part of their work. Laura Hafner harvests grain for farmers from Texas to North Dakota. She says it can be a cheaper alternative for farmers who don't want to repair or pay for costly upgrades.
Oftentimes, farmers only engage in harvesting for a short period of time. While they might use it for several weeks or maybe a month, the rest of that year, that equipment's going to sit in the shed or in the lot, not doing anything. It's not making money.
The service is a good option for some farmers, but it doesn't work for everyone. For many farmers, mending their old equipment is one way to stay afloat for now until the farm economy improves.
That was Harvest Public Media's Emma George Griffin. The story is part of Tough Times, a series examining the economic pressures facing American farmers in 2026.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 138 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. As the Colorado River reaches new and dire levels, 30 federally recognized tribes along the river have no formal seat in negotiations. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Jimmy Romo visits with one of those tribes fighting for the future of the river.
The Colorado River stretches 1,450 miles across the U.S., and for just 17 miles, the river flows through the Fort Mojave Indian Tribes Reservation, which spans across 3 states, Arizona, California, and Nevada.
Let's go to the pumps.
That's the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe Chairman Timothy Williams on a humid triple-digit day in the valley. He's showing me around the tribe's checkerboard farmland in Arizona. That's the state in which the tribe has the most water rights. The tribe has roughly been allotted 133,000 acre-feet of water a year, enough to sustain over 250,000 households. Most of that goes to their alfalfa and upland cotton operation, which pays for their healthcare services, housing, a state-of-the-art elementary school, and other services. But as states, cities, and the federal government fight over the future of the river, all of that is at risk, and tribes like the Fort Mojave are often left out of the negotiations.
There is a long history of not successfully including tribes in basin governance or water management.
That was Jay Weiner, a water attorney for the Kitsan Indian Tribe, co-founder and member of the Water and Tribes Initiative leadership team.
And so there is a significant tension there and difficulty presented by not bringing tribes to the table.
Back on the Fort Mojave Reservation, Williams parks his truck on the dirt road to visit the pump that takes water from the river to large central pivot irrigators.
Look at over there. Multi-million dollar homes that are right there across the river. And here's our infrastructure and trying to provide for an entire people.
The pumps are housed in a metal cage above the river. When the water goes below the rock line, it's too low to be pumped.
So depending upon the decisions that are made, wherever they are, they heavily impact us, and it only comes down to a couple of feet where we can be impacted completely.
The chairman squats down to touch the water.
You can see how close it is already. It's that close, only a couple of feet determines whether or not we're able to provide for our people. It's that close right now.
Last winter, the water levels were so low that the tribe's pump was unable to pull water for their crops for 4 months. It's the first time that's ever happened. Andrew Harder is the farm manager for the Fort Mojave Tribe.
If we keep encountering these same conditions with our current pumping stations, it's going to really, really limit what we can grow here. So that's going to be one of our biggest obstacles on the farming side, which we've never had to.
Colleen Nielsch-Garcia, who is the secretary for the Fort Mojave Indian Tribal Council, says the tribe's connection to the river is much deeper than its financial benefit.
When Creator created the people, he placed the Mojave people in this area. And our traditional name is called Ahamakav, and that's people who live along the river. And he designated us as the caretakers of the river, the Colorado River.
Garcia says Fort Mojave elders can remember how the river once was.
Over the years, you know, we've seen the changes that have come, and we've seen the river being dammed up. We've seen it getting smaller and smaller, and every year, you know, it gets smaller and it just hurts our people.
The Bureau of Reclamation recently released a proposal which includes cuts for California, Arizona, and Nevada. Further cuts are still on the table. But without tribal members at the negotiating table, Jay Weiner says the proposal was underwhelming.
What we're looking at right now is it's a band-aid. I think there had been hope that what we would have is a durable 20-year framework.
This means Timothy Williams and the Mojave people are looking at an uncertain future.
These are the things that keep us up at night. These are the things that we consider, but we are a strong and resilient people, Fort Mojave, and we will continue on. No matter what takes place, you know, no matter what decisions take place out there, we will continue on, and we will continue on as a people out there.
In other words, the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe has no intention of abandoning their fight for the river. Jimmy Romo for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Tune in next week to hear more from Jimmy Romo about his reporting on the Colorado River. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
The goldenrods are starting to put on their annual floral show. Much as the pasque flowers in bloom serve as harbingers of spring, the goldenrods are harbingers of fall. They're telling us that the days of summer are numbered and fall is fast approaching. There are somewhere around 10 species of goldenrods native to North Dakota. Canada goldenrod is probably the most commonly observed goldenrod. It grows to around 2 to 3 feet tall and produces a pyramid-shaped inflorescence. Look for it in low prairie, road ditches, and similar sites across the state. Stiff goldenrod is also quite common and widespread. It's a little shorter than Canada goldenrod and produces a flat-topped inflorescence, which is quite distinctive. A couple other shorter species, Missouri goldenrod and gray goldenrod, are frequently observed in upland prairie. Consider getting out and walking through some natural areas and taking a closer look at the goldenrods and other wildflowers. And when you encounter a goldenrod, particularly stiff goldenrod, look closely in the flowers for ambush bugs. They're some mean-looking dudes. To say they're interesting insects would be an understatement. Ambush bugs are around a half inch long. Their coloration is variable, but often mottled with pale yellows, greens, and/or browns. And they have a strange shape with massive front legs, think Arnold Schwarzenegger's biceps, which are used to catch prey. Ambush bugs are well camouflaged in amongst the yellow flowers of goldenrods. So as their common name implies, they often are observed hiding amongst the goldenrod flowers, waiting to ambush a smaller unsuspecting insect, such as a fly or small bee. Once caught, the ambush bug then injects its victim with a paralyzing substance and enzymes that liquefy the internal organs. It then sucks out the liquid contents of its victim. All that's left is an empty exoskeleton. I've put links to more information on goldenrods and ambush bugs, including a video of ambush bugs, along with a text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. I'm J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist, naturalist, and writer. Names are important as they help us tell one thing from the next. My name is Drew. What's yours? Easy enough. Birds aren't so simple. Or rather, we've complicated things that could be simpler. Take my grandmother Mamatha's redbirds. They became northern cardinals and Cardinalis cardinalis as I learned more about proper scientific nomenclature. But some days, even with lots of degrees attached to my name, they are redbirds again. And so on, with yellow-billed cuckoos back to rain crows calling out before a storm. Great-horned owls back to cat owls because of those feather tufts that look like ears. And juncos that arrive in the fall back to snowbirds. In other words, my grandmother had her own ornithology, her own names for birds. I have mine. Each of us can build our own ornithology and our personal names for these creatures. Keep it simple. What stands out to you about these birds? Once you have a name that means something to you, you'll never forget it. For Bird Note, I'm J. Drew Lanham.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 18th. North Dakota experiences frequent thunderstorms, averaging 25 to 35 storms each year. The storm season usually runs from late spring through early fall. The state is located in the path of winds that bring warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico. The flat terrain allows those winds to move freely, with little to impede the formation of storms. North Dakota storms range from mild to severe and can produce heavy rain, strong winds, hail, and of course, lightning. Lightning is one of the oldest observed natural phenomena. It can be seen in volcanic eruptions, intense forest fires, and hurricanes, but it occurs most often during thunderstorms. Lightning is a giant spark of electricity in the atmosphere. When opposite charges build up enough, there's a rapid discharge of electricity. Lightning can heat the surrounding atmosphere to between 18,000 and 60,000 degrees Fahrenheit. While lightning can occur without thunder, thunder is always accompanied by lightning. On this night in 1922, a bolt out of the blue got the attention of Washburn residents. There was no storm and no rain was falling, but people all over town said the lightning woke them from a sound sleep. The single bolt was the only one to hit Washburn, but one family had an experience that was too close for comfort. The home of Axel Nelson took a direct hit. Mrs. Nelson had just gotten up to go to her daughter's room, and the room she had just left was struck by lightning. It was unnerving to think what might have happened if she'd have stayed there. Archie Nelson ran to the attic to see if a fire had started. The bolt struck the ridge of the roof and followed a metal rain spout to the ground, but there was no fire. When the lightning reached the foundation, it exploded, tearing siding off the house. Fuses were blown in nearby homes. The Nelsons were fortunate that no one was injured. North Dakotans are very familiar with thunderstorms and the danger of lightning. The National Weather Service offers safety guidelines. While indoors, stay away from doors and windows. Bring pets inside. Never take a shower or a bath during a thunderstorm. And remember the advice, when thunder roars, go indoors. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us.
Tomorrow on the show, 480 miles of remembrance, the 1015 Project. 12 runners will relay across North Dakota to honor babies gone too soon and support families navigating pregnancy and infant loss. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.